Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. My name is Mildred J. Menlo. With my colleague, Ruth Weiner, we are interviewing Mr. William Block at his office at the Post-Gazette. Where were you born, Mr. Block?
I was born in New York City.
When?
September 20th, 1915.
Your parents, what were their names?
My father was Paul Block, and he was brought over as a child. His family came from Königsberg in East Prussia, which is now Russian territory. I think it's called Kaliningrad. They came over about 1880. He was born in 1876 and went to Elmira, New York.
How did they get there?
I have never learned exactly why his father took them to Elmira. It must have been friends or maybe a relative, but I have never heard of a particular relative. But they went to Elmira, and my father was brought up there, went to school there, and started work at a very young age as an advertising salesman for the Elmira Telegram. And my mother was born in New York. Her father had come over from Hanover in Germany. Must have come over in the 1870s. He was a school teacher, and he saw opportunities because of the great number of immigrants coming over, of going into the real estate business and owning these tenements that immigrants would move into. And
when were your parents married?
My parents were married in 1907, and that was a recession year, so their honeymoon was a weekend in Atlantic City.
We don't have their names or your grandparents' names.
Well, my mother's name was Dina Wallach.
D-I-N-A?
D-I-N-A. Wallach, W-A-L-L-A-C-H. And, of course, my father's name was Paul Block.
And grandparents, their names?
His father was John Block, I believe. If I knew him as a very small child. He died in New York. My father brought my Aunt Molly, who was a maiden aunt, and their father to New York, and she took care of him. And I guess my father paid the expenses. And I think he died in the early 20s. I was born 1915. I might have known him when I was 6 or 7, but I have very little memory of him, but a very fond memory of my Aunt Molly, who used to take me to Child's Restaurant for baked apples. They had a baked apple with raisins on the top and lots of brown sugar, and that was a favorite of mine. And
I had been missing Webster Hall's old coffee shop for 100 years because of their baked apples.
So,
and on your mother's side, the Wallachs, can you, her father?
Her father was named Carl.
C? With a C or K?
I think a C.
All right.
There's a strange story to that, which I could do later.
No, go ahead.
The back home family.
Well, when I was born, they gave me the middle name of Carl, but with a C. Yeah, with a C. So it must have been my mother's father, who was Carl with a C. But for some reason or other, I thought it was a K. So when I went in the army, I gave my name as William Carl with a K, and didn't learn that it was a C until I got back from the service and was going to apply for a passport and had to get a birth certificate. I learned it was with a C. So with all that confusion, I dropped the middle name. I've never used it since. I felt that if Abraham,
solve that problem.
If George Washington and Abraham Lincoln could get along without a middle name, I could.
Brothers and sisters, Mr. Flock.
I had one brother who was 4.5 years older. He died in 1987.
Name.
In fact, yesterday was his birthday.
You always remember.
Hmm?
You always remember.
Yeah.
His name was?
Paul Block Jr. And in the families, it's quite interesting. My mother's family, there were 9 children, and her mother died in childbirth, and her older sister's mother died in childbirth. And each time, Mr. Carl Wallach would go back to Germany and get a new bride and come over. So he had over us, and I guess that was common in those days, because so many women did die in childbirth. He had 3 wives and 9 children. And my father's family also had 9 children, but 4 of them died in a diphtheria epidemic. I can't remember exactly when that epidemic was, but it was probably around the 1890s, somewhere in there, 95. My father moved from Elmira to New York in 1895. He was 19 years old, and he went to work for J. Frank Richardson. Mr. Richardson represented the Elmira Telegram for the sale of national advertising. Usually a newspaper doesn't try to sell national advertising itself. It usually has a representative, a broker, who sells national advertising for the newspaper. And so he got into that business, and in 1900, he had a falling out with Mr. Richardson, and because Mr. Richardson was, well, in those days, national advertising was almost all patent medicines, cure-alls of one sort or another, you know, mostly from New England. My father was doing all the selling. For the newspapers. He also was contacting a lot of the publishers as he went along. So Mr. Richardson got interested in one of these patent medicines and took less and less interest in his representation business. So he put a nephew in charge of the representation business, and my father, I guess, thought that he should have been put in charge. So in 1900, he left. And he started his own representation organization, and a number of the publishers who only knew him and hadn't seen Richardson in some time went with him, and he started to build a business, which at that time was called Paul Block Inc., and later Paul Block and Associates. And he built a rather substantial representation business.
Who were the associates?
Names? A boyhood friend from Elmira, Herman Halstead, Cornelius Regan, who used to show me a little piece of paper where he had been increased from $6, I think, to $8 a week. Gradually built an organization of very good people. The business grew because national advertising was growing. The automobile was starting up, and you know, a great variety of tires, cigarettes, a lot of things were coming on the market which were advertised nationally.
Advertising, yes.
And of course, there was not yet any real development of radio, no real development of television. Magazines were the only competition, really. And in probably around the World War I time, my father's organization became the advertising department for Pictorial Review magazine, which was one of the three leading women's magazines at that time: Woman's Home Companion, Ladies' Home Journal, and Pictorial Review were the three big women's magazines at the time of World War I. Doesn't sound anything like what you think it does.
You lived in New York. Where in New York did you live, Mr. Block?
I think I was born on the West Side, but my memory mostly is of living at 62nd Street and Park Avenue. 555 Park Avenue. And my father was a very nervous man about the safety of his children. I wasn't allowed to cross the street without somebody with me. I attended Cutler School, which was a private school on Madison Avenue, and I think around 65th or 66th Street. And my brother went through Cutler the whole eight grades. I only went through four grades, and the school closed. So then I was entered in Beauvais School, which was another private school on Fifth Avenue near 65th Street.
Beauvais. B-E-A-U?
B-O-V-E-E. And Kate Beauvais was the person who passed on my admission, and then I guess it was such a shock she died. So I never knew Kate Beauvais, who apparently was a very good educator. And her rather ineffective but lovely sister, Eleanor Beauvais, succeeded to the school, but she just couldn't cut the mustard, I'm afraid. She couldn't operate it. And she had a terrible time. Fortunately, it lasted long enough that I graduated from there, and the education was excellent. We had some very good teachers. The school closed. She sold the building. They were going to build an apartment house at the corner of 65th and 5th, and her brownstone, where the school operated, was needed for that. And I guess she got a very good price and a nice retirement from it. But I remember that when I was about, let's say, 9 or 10 years old at that school, she would call me into her office and discuss her problems, as if a 10-year-old could help her solve some of her naughtier difficulties. But I was a serious little boy, I guess, and she had a sentimental attachment because I was the last child that her sister had admitted to the school. So we used to have some interesting discussions. I'm sure I wasn't of much help, but at least she was able to unburden herself.
That's right. You provided a willing ear.
A sounding board.
Childhood associations at that time. What did you do for recreation? Or what was your family life? at that time?
Well, my father was very much interested in the theater, and especially musicals. And he had many good friends in the theater in New York. He was a good friend of Florence Ziegfeld's, of Irving Berlin. I have a picture of them together at a baseball game, standing in a box at Yankee Stadium. So I attended quite a bit of theater as a boy, and when I had birthdays, we used to have birthday parties where I took a number of my classmates to see a show. I remember that we went to see a show with Billy Burke, who was Florence Ziegfeld's wife, and for some reason or other, there was a mix-up on the tickets, and our tickets were wrong or something. And so we had to sit on the steps or something in the balcony and watch the show, but it was a good show and we enjoyed it. I attended one of the first performances of Showboat at the Ziegfeld Theater when it opened in about 1930. My mother attended concerts and opera. My father had no interest in that. And my mother didn't try to take me at all. And I did not get any training, really, in classical music or opera as a boy.
No musical education? No musical education?
No, I studied the piano a bit, but I wasn't very skilled, and nobody pressed me very hard, and so that kind of petered out. And then I went away to school at 13. I went away to the Hotchkiss School in Lakeville, Connecticut.
Hotchkiss.
And
Hotchkiss.
It's in the northwest corner of Connecticut at Lakeville, Connecticut. It's south of where Tanglewood is in Massachusetts. It's on that.
It's still in existence.
Mm-hmm.
Still in existence.
Still very much in existence, yes. Went co-ed some years ago and has about 500 attending. Yes, a good school. And I was there 4 years, and then I went to Yale from there. It was almost automatic that if you went to Hotchkiss, you went to Yale. The vast majority of the class went to Yale.
Majored in?
At that time. I majored in government and international relations.
Were you interested in any sports when you were younger?
Well, I was a very small boy. I was only 5'6" when I graduated from Hotchkiss. Hmm. And I didn't weigh much more than 100 pounds, or maybe 110 pounds.
A late bloomer.
And I always kid that the next year in New Haven, it rained so much, I grew 6 inches. I grew 6 inches over freshman year, and ended up at 6'1". And when I would go back to Hotchkiss reunions, they wouldn't recognize me. My classmates couldn't understand what had happened, because all the pictures taken at Hotchkiss, I'm the smallest boy in the class, and I wasn't much of an athlete. I took boxing in the winter term. In the spring term, I played golf, but I wasn't. You know, I wasn't on any golf team, but that was one of the sport. You had to pick one sport. So I played golf. And I wasn't very good, but...
I've been trying for 40 years.
They had a nice course there at the school. And so that's what I did for athletics. In the fall, I was in the lightest weight football team that they could find, and pretty terrible. And it was suggested to me that maybe I'd be better at soccer. So anyway, but I wasn't an athlete, and I really enjoyed swimming, because we had a swimming pool at home. My father, in 1926, bought a place in Westchester. Our address was King Street, Porchester, New York. But it really was across the Connecticut line. King Street runs along the New York-Connecticut line between Porchester and Armonk, New York, right near where the Westchester Airport is today. It wasn't then. And this was a big place he bought. He was a fairly heavy gambler in the stock market, and he made a great deal of money in the 20s. And so he bought this estate, which was right near Bernard Gimbel's estate, the Gimbel Stores, who ran the Gimbel operation. And I think it was Bernard Gimbel who suggested to him the place was available. So in 1926, we moved there. He built a swimming pool. And I did a lot of swimming. And he hired a young woman who was an Olympic swimmer. I don't remember her name now. But she also was hired by Mr. Ziegfeld to be a companion and teach swimming to Ziegfeld's daughter, Patricia. And so anyway, I think it was probably through that connection that we had her, and she, of course, she taught me the crawl and various strokes. I was never very great, but when I went to Yale, in those days, Mr. Kiputh, K-I-P-H-U-T-H, was the swimming coach, and Yale had championship swimming teams for a number of years in that period. And everybody who could even have a slight claim to swimming was immediately recruited by Kiputh for his swimming team, and he would make you go to the pool with a board in front of you and kick up and down the length of the pool endlessly. And I got sort of, I kind of realized that I was not going to be a tremendous a swimmer of the caliber that they needed, and so I kind of let it slip after that. But that's the only athletic competition that I could claim to. In boxing, as I told you, I took boxing, and the boxing coach was George Salling. I think it was S-A-L-L-I-N-G, but I'm not sure. Anyway, George liked me, but he never could find anybody small enough to box with me. But finally, my senior year, there was a young man named Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, who was a first-year man, and he was a little heavier than I was, but not quite as skilled, because I had been boxing for several years. So he matched me in what they call the Brian Belt bouts, which were their championship bouts. We were the first bout of the evening. It was very cold in that old gymnasium, and I remember being in boxing trunks and very little else, and shivering from the cold. I was so skinny and small. And Gene Tunney, the former world champion, heavyweight boxing champion, was the referee. But you know, he liked to make speeches about Shakespeare. He liked to show his prowess as a Shakespearean student. So he gave us a talk before, and here was Charlie Wright sitting in one corner, and I'm sitting in the other corner, I'm shivering. And we didn't get started. I was practically frozen stiff by the time the bout started. And I saw this punch coming from practically from his heels. And he knocked me down. And Gene Tunney, you know, one of the famous incidents between Gene Tunney and Jack Dempsey was an alleged long count.
That's right.
That Tunney got. Well, he gave me the longest count any any boxer ever had. He was brushing the rosin off my gloves endlessly while I stabilized myself. So then he put me back in. I took an awful beating for 3 rounds and, of course, lost the bout. But I did stay up on my feet. And that was the end of my boxing, boxing history.
Did you do much reading?
Well, there was a great deal of required reading. I'm not sure that I was as good a reader as I wish I'd been. Everyone regrets that they haven't read more, I think. I read originally in the early days the same things that all boys read, the Hardy Boys and those things. But I was more, I think, a newspaper and magazine reader. And at a fairly early age was reading magazines like Harper's and of course I was devoted to the New York Times, living in the New York area. And the Herald Tribune was a good newspaper in those days too. So I was a fairly strong newspaper reader, and I would say my book reading was not as good as it should have been.
Did you decide early in your educational period about what you wanted to study or where you wanted to go?
Well, I think I was very close with my father, whereas my brother was not as close to him. My brother was more independent, I think. And I was very close to my father. I admired my father tremendously, and I sat with him, and he would bring people up to, he called this estate he bought Friendship, and he would bring to Friendship a great number of his associates and other people. I remember when Ray Scriggle of the Post Gazette came there to talk about the Hugo Black series. And I remember Cy Hungerford coming to stay for a day. And then Oliver Keller was running the Post Gazette in those days, and he would come there. And Grove Patterson from Toledo, the editor in Toledo, would come in. In the late 20s, my father had branched out, and he first started to acquire newspapers that he represented nationally and who were in some trouble, and he wanted to save the newspaper because he wanted to continue the national representation of the paper. So he acquired the Newark Star Eagle, Newark, New Jersey, at a receivership, a sale, I think. He represented the New York Mail, which was an evening paper. And then the New York Mail during World War I was seized by the enemy property custodian, having allegedly German influence. And so the enemy property custodian took it over, and then my father, because he was representing it for National Advertising, offered to buy it with along with Henry Stoddard, who was then the editor, and the two of them bought the New York Mail, and they didn't do too well with it. And when the price of newsprint went soaring after World War I, they were beginning to lose money, and they finally sold out to Muncie, who bought so many papers that formed the New York Sun. And but he gradually got into a number of newspapers, and in 1926 he bought the Toledo Blade, and in 1927 he was involved in the combinations that became the Sun Telegraph and the Post Gazette in Pittsburgh. Prior to that, there had been five newspapers in Pittsburgh. In fact, early in the 20s, there were seven newspapers in Pittsburgh. The Leader and the Dispatch were put out of their misery by the other publishers.
End of side one, continued on side two.
Very happy with that idea, but the other publishers got a fund together and got the Dispatch and the Leader